it was easier for me, and it is easier for me as a personality, to come into an already operating organization and find the opportunities for improvement and fixing them than it is building something from scratch. I can look at a process and be the seagull that comes in and shits on everything and then flies away and say, hey, this is wrong. This is what we need to do to fix it. This is how we do it. Let's go fix it.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk-takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of speaking with Mason McDonald. Now, Mason is a former hospital CEO turned full-time real estate investor. And get this, 3 months after getting started, he was able to leave his full-time job and pursue real estate investing full-time. That is absolutely unheard of. And the most people talk about on this show don't take years to get to that point. So awesome for Mason. But Mason's niche within the real estate investing is actually in land. And his company, RM Golden, acquires, develops, and sells land in the US and has become a seven-figure revenue-generating company after it's just second year in operation. His other company, Ground Up Partners, which he manages with his business partner, Dan Habenkost, who we just had on the show, provides joint venture funding for land deals throughout the country. I'm really pumped and excited to have him on the show to share his incredible insights and knowledge. But enough out of me. Let's get him out here. G'day, Mason. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
Doing great, Reid. How are you?
Good, good, good. And you just got back from an awesome trip to Japan, right?
Yeah, celebrated my five-year anniversary just a couple of days ago, and had a great trip with my wife and a few friends while we were there, and loved it. But back in the States, back in business.
Yeah, love it. We're just talking about getting sick from traveling, but in the green room. But it's those good things of being sick when you're coming back into a holiday from a holiday and all that sort of good stuff. But it's always really important to take time to get away, to travel internationally, to experience other cultures. So what was the highlight, by the way?
I hate to say it, but the food, the steak in particular, when we were in the Kyoto region, was just out of this world, unlike anything I've had in the States. And yeah, just getting to experience the food and sharing their culture through their food and enjoying it together with locals and people traveling was a ton of fun.
A good Wagyu beef?
Oh, yeah. A5 Wagyu. And it was cheap. The yen is super favorable right now. So, it was affordable compared to what you could get in the U.S. And man, I'm still thinking about this one bite of tempura Wagyu that I had. It'll live with me forever.
Oh, mate, I think it's the combination of traveling, getting a piece of steak or some food that would cost you an arm and a leg in the US and get like that. That just makes, the trip's at half price, you know, you're pretty much getting it for free. So, I love those moments. But, mate, let's get into the show. Can you rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first ever dollar as a kid?
Ooh, first ever dollar as a kid. I was always looking for ways to get money out of my parents. And so any extra chores on top of my required chores, I could typically get paid for. And that worked for a little while until they could take advantage of the free slave labor that they got out of me. But landscaping projects, doing extra stuff around the house, everything. But man, I started working part-time and then full-time at a job at a swimming pool store when I was 15 years old. So I was essentially working full-time since 15.
Yeah, right. What's the what was the relationship like with money growing up with your family?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So I have divorced parents, and within that, I kind of have the rich dad, poor dad mindset that I got from each of them, where my mom and stepdad, you know, so Jewish mom, like my entire upbringing was like, Mason, you have to be a doctor or a lawyer. My stepdad's a hardware engineer. So there's not very many of those out there in terms of jobs that are going to last for a very long time. If you're the only one that's doing it, there's some security in that. But it was always more education, more education, more education. They paid cash for everything. Every house they bought was in cash, everything. They never had any debt, and they don't have any debt. And then there was my dad that inherited a commercial real estate portfolio when he was younger. And I never really saw him work a day in his life. So he was just cashing rent checks and taking me along when I was 3 or 4 years old to, you know, talk to the tenants and say, you know, can't feed my kids unless you're paying me rent. And so I had an interesting dynamic where on my dad's side, like we had private planes growing up. We had boats, we had multiple homes. And then my mom's side, we lived in, you know, a comfortable suburban house, but So I had a very interesting relationship growing up with money, where I had a tendency to save a lot and also had a tendency to spend a lot. So kind of weird.
Yeah, that would have having the taste for the final things in life would definitely given a perspective. But you know, in the intro, you were a CEO of a hospital. Like that's not that's no mean feat. So average feat, I should say. So talk to us a little bit about that journey and you've come back around into real estate. You know, spoiler alert. But did you know that you'd come back into real estate? Like given that your upbringing with your dad?
Yeah, and I think real estate was always the answer for me. I was good at school, graduated towards the top of my class in high school, you know, did well in undergrad. And, you know, I'll get into the story of how I got into healthcare administration and subsequently real estate. But even on my mom's side, I knew real estate was the answer. My great grandfather on my mom's side developed Boca Raton like 60, 70 years ago. So there was always that real estate in the blood. But growing up in my mom's house and kind of seeing my dad's party lifestyle and everything and the chaos that it brought, I was definitely more interested in having the stable kind of career where having the Jewish mom where it was doctor or lawyer. And I thought I liked science more, which is why I picked doctor when majored in neuroscience and, you know, minor in biochem, took the MCAT and everything, was ready to go to medical school and devote the rest of my life to medicine. And then senior year of college, I realized I hated my life and I hated science and I did not want to do that anymore and made the pivot into healthcare administration, which was introduced to me through a research supervisor at an internship that I had. He was like, Mason, you're more business minded, you're more entrepreneurial, you'll do better in the business world, but you can stay in business by going into healthcare administration. Didn't realize it was an option. So pursued that, got into grad school 5 days before graduating from undergrad, because even though neuroscience sounds like a sexy degree that's going to give you a job that makes a lot of money, my career options were waiter or bartender with a neuroscience degree. And so got into grad school, did well, and worked my way up to the top very, very rapidly after going through grad school. Became a CEO of a hospital at 26, got a promotion every year from graduation until I ended up leaving my job. But that's kind of how I got to CEO of a hospital and kind of my initial background.
26, being a CEO of a hospital, that seems to me very young. You know, I don't know anything about hospitals, but 26, I certainly didn't know anything about hospitals. You know, like to get that confidence, you know, kudos to you, but also you know, very young, very youthful. How did that go down, you know, with the board and all that sort of stuff?
Oh, yeah. And your reaction is appropriate. And like, it should be yikes. 26-year-olds are tough. I was a kid. And I think, you know, kind of looking back on my career, and I think a lot of people will laugh hearing my career of 4 years of, you know, from administrative resident to associate administrator to chief operating officer to CEO. And we'll be like, okay, that's a 20-year career. And it took me 4. I don't say that in a bragging way. I think I worked in behavioral health. So there's more opportunity in the industry. It's more antiquated. It's slower. And being able to go in, you know, having, you know, good grad school education, certified Lean Six Sigma Black Belt, expert in process improvement, and pretty good at leadership. I've read so many leadership books and was always kind of drawn towards leadership positions where I really, really respected the employees and the staff. And I recognized that if you take great care of your employees, they're going to take great care of your patients. And then everything follows from that. And that's just kind of like business in general. You take really good care of people that are better and smarter at executing on their individual tasks. And then they're going to take care of you in the long run. So I made it to answer why and how at 26 I became a CEO is I made the organization I was working for a lot of money through the practices that I was doing. And I think my rare and valuable skill I have beyond being a good operator, which I hate operations. Operations is something that I'm really good at, but it's really painful for me. I like talking. I like being on podcasts. I enjoy sharing my story, but I feel like I was really good at inspiring a shared vision among my employees and people around me to get them to believe in me and to trust me. And they're able to trust me because they see my track record and my ability to execute on what I say I'm going to execute on.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit, because I think that's so important, the leadership and coming into a role that I'm sure a lot of people at a hospital organization would be so bureaucratic and political. And, you know, he got, you know, sharp elbows and all that sort of stuff. He got the promotion over me. So How do you come in and gain that respect in that environment?
It's a great question because, as you can imagine, everyone I managed was 10 years to triple my age. I came into the hospital as COO February of 2020. So everyone knows what happened a month later, which was obviously very tricky to navigate. And I took over the entirety of operations. My former CEO, who eventually became my VP that promoted me into that new CEO position, gained a lot of trust and respect for me. As I touched down in February, he wasn't there and I had to lead the executive meeting on my very first day. Some child from Texas coming out to Colorado. And the first thing I said, as I introduced myself, I was like, man, you guys got this car dealership mountain out here where there's these big old car dealerships on the mountain. They're like, what the hell is this guy talking about? Because now that I've lived in Colorado 4 years, it's just like car dealerships on a hill. But coming from the flatlands, like, they were like, who is this flatlander hick that just came and touched down that, can't grow a full beard? And, when he shaves, he still gets like razor burn and stuff like that. That came in. But I think that what allowed me to succeed is anything that I'm doing, I really devote my time and energy to become an expert in it to the degree that I need to be an expert in it. So I knew healthcare. I knew how to run a hospital and all the theory. And I had had a lot of success coming from, the previous hospital, which was much larger than the one that I came over and took over the operations. So I got lucky. I got lucky in where I started my career, and then I was able to succeed in that environment whenever I was allowed to. But I think most importantly, in healthcare, and for anyone that's in healthcare that's listening, hospital administrators are not a loved position in hospitals. If people know what they are, I mean, it's the suits at the top that are making all these financial decisions. They're not the doctors or nurses or techs or people that are involved in the care of the patient directly. They're in charge of the business and making sure that they keep the lights on, which usually means making tough and hard decisions. And I think by having my approach of, my goal was always to empower the people that are taking care of patients. And through doing that and communicating that, I was able to gain a lot of respect from the leaders where, as a COO, I rounded on the units every day. I'm walking through, checking on all the patients, checking on the staff every single day for multiple times a day. And all the staff were like, who is this man child in a suit coming and checking and asking if he can do anything for us? Like, the administrators can never do anything for us. And I was able to develop so much trust and so many small wins by a nurse, I remember, complained that her computer was really slow. I got her a new computer the next day. And she was like, oh, my chair sucks. I've had the same chair for 20 years. I got her a new chair the next day. And just like these quick little wins and executing on these small tasks, people started saying, oh, Mason's doing something. Like, and I think whenever you're in a large organization, you might hear that and you might be like, oh, people don't care about that. If you're sitting at a freaking chair for 10 hours a day and it's really uncomfortable and you're able to get like some new orthopedic chair or whatever, ergonomic chair, it makes a huge difference in these people's life. And that's what I think people overcomplicate about leadership is ask your employees what they want, what they need to do well in their job. And then if you can execute on it as a leader or communicate with them why you can't, you're going to garner a lot of trust and respect. And I think that right there is kind of what allowed the staff to like me, is because a chief nursing officer sees how much I'm advocating for her nurses and says, oh, like, this guy rocks. Or a chief clinical officer that sees me going on the units and playing with the kids that are in the hospital and like during therapeutic activities and how much of an impact and joy that I'm able to, bring the kids on a random day. They're like, this person cares about the patients, which is why I got into this job.
How do you go about making a hospital more money?
In behavioral health, it's I'll try and shorten this question because I can talk about this stuff for hours.
I'm not trying to get a PhD in it, but I'm just interested because I'm trying to draw a line between operational efficiencies in any business, big, large, or small. There's still the same fundamentals that you can apply anywhere.
1,000%. So it's exactly what you would expect, is reduction in cost and increase in revenue. So where can you cut costs that is not going to harm the quality of patient care or the quality of the operation?
Give me an example of that. Like, what would be something in a hospital that you would cut a cost? Because in a hospital, you think everything's bloody, needed, because if you cut a bed, I'm sure you're not cutting beds, but what's an example of that?
I mean, there's opportunities for labor efficiency, which no one ever wants to hear. But I think looking at the supply chain is really effective. Looking at vendor relationships of, am I spending too much money from this particular person? And if you're a part of a large corporation that has tremendous buying power, can we renegotiate some of these contracts to make it so where we can reduce our expenditure of, you know, food costs, for instance, of why are we spending so much money on food and why is the quality so bad? Oh, we're throwing away 50% of it. Let's get better quality ingredients and increase output and use, you know, more made to ready, you know, ready to order stuff instead of fresh stuff that we are hiring people at a cheap rate that don't know how to cook it. So, I mean, you can like kind of go back and, you know, determine the root cause of, oh, the food's bad because of this, that, and the other thing. And you can see how you can cut costs there by getting better materials and, you know, having less waste there. Or, and then on the flip side of it, with increasing revenue in most hospitals, the more patients you have, the more services you're providing, the more money you're going to be able to make. And one of the unfortunate soul-sucking sides of healthcare is the payer mix, where if you are if you have more patients that have commercial insurance, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Aetna, that or TRICARE military insurance, they typically reimburse at a higher rate than, you know, like a Medicaid or a managed Medicaid product. So there's that unfortunate soul sucking side of it. And I was pretty good at military relations and able to drive a good amount of military care as well. So those are two high level things. And I mean, I can jump into service line marketing strategy and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know, maybe anyone in the healthcare industry that has a podcast about healthcare can reach out and I'll chat about this stuff all day. But it's exactly what we expect. Increase revenue, decrease expense, and then increase expense into things that increase your revenue, just like any other business.
I don't know anything about hospitals. It's not a podcast about hospitals, but it's still something that you would come into. As an outsider, you're sort of driving a big ship so that the efficiencies of that would be seem to be easier than, say, a bootstrap business, you know, which we're going to get into right now. But how have you been able to draw upon the experiences from being a CEO of a hospital into what you're building today? And we just interviewed your business partner, but you can just maybe give us an overview of what you're doing today. And how's that challenged you in a way that you have had that efficiency because you've had a massive budget in a hospital versus coming into essentially a startup with you got to shoestring everything together?
Yeah, I think that right there is one of the more challenging transitions where I think a lot of people that come into this self-starter, solopreneur, entrepreneurial space, you know, I feel like a lot of my colleagues and peers just never quite made it in corporate America or didn't make it necessarily to the top. Not to say that they couldn't, but they didn't have that corporate America bone in them. And I get it, I didn't quite either. And so coming out of an executive position where I had a couple dozen direct reports and I'm a part of a Fortune 200 organization that had all the resources where I could, at the dial of a phone, call someone that's a $2,000 an hour corporate attorney and it just gets washed into the corporate budget. It's a huge transition, but I think what was most challenging for me and like my serving of humble pie that I got was I thought I was really freaking good at, you know, business. And then you jump into this role and I got lucky on my first deal. I got, you know, six figures on my first land flip. That allowed, you know, propelled me into being able to really, you know, succeed in this just to, you know, get more cash. But I think it was easier for me and it is easier for me as a personality to come into an already operating organization and find the opportunities for improvement and fixing them than it is building something from scratch, where I can look at a process and be the seagull that comes in and shits on everything and then flies away. And say, hey, this is wrong. This is what we need to do to fix it. This is how we do it. Let's go fix it. As versus, okay, someone needs to, you know, create a marketing strategy and start, you know, spending a lot of money marketing to get deals. And you look around and you're like, oh,
and there's no money.
And there's no money. And there's no marketing department. And there's no marketing people to do it. You're like looking around and you're like, oh crap. Well, I guess I have to do that. I have to figure that out. And then if you're my personality, which I hate documentation. I hate doing documentation. I love having it where I'm like doing all these processes, like I'm operating, you know, flying by the seat of my pants. And I look back and I'm like, I wish I had documented and recorded every process I've ever done, because it would be so much easier now, a few years into business, having a cache of 300 SOPs for every process within the business that I could now go back and edit. So I think that's kind of my long form answer to that question of it was way easier to go in and fix something than build something from the ground up. Surprisingly to me, that surprised me.
Hey guys, this is a quick ad for our latest multifamily investment opportunity called the Avalon Apartments, located in Dallas, Texas, the fastest growing MSA in the nation. Now, rapid fire, here are the three reasons why we love this asset. Firstly, great investor returns of over 20% annualized. The second thing, of the 226 units, 30% have already been renovated and they're achieving a $250 rental premium. Now, our business plan is pretty simple. We'll come in and renovate the remaining 70% to achieve those proven rental levels, then rely on a modest 3% rent growth thereafter. It's very conservative, very straightforward, and the same thing we have been doing successfully for over a decade. Now, last thing, pricing for multifamily apartment properties have fallen more today than they did during the 2008 global financial crisis. This could very well be the best time in commercial real estate cycle to pick up cheap assets. If you're interested to find out more, click on the link below. So, well, I don't think it surprises many people. Like, and we can talk about now, like the pivot that I know we're talking about internally at RSN, that we're a private equity company. At the end of the day, we raise money from investors. What do? We raise money and find deals. Now, deals have historically been multifamily, but they might change. You know, there might be land deals, but there might also be operating businesses that we might go buy that are adjacent to real estate investing. We're looking at a steel manufacturing company right now that builds modular housing. I tell you what, it'd be a lot easier to go in there with the mindset that Bobby, you and I both have. It seems like we're cut from the similar cloth, that you can identify very quickly inefficiencies, but have the sort of system or at least the backing to be like, well, we can change it, rather than being like, well, I'm the one-man band and I've got to now spend 40 hours and it's not actually propelling the business forward. So there is a lure as a business owner to going and buying an existing machine to sort of grease the cogs, rather than going and getting a spanner and a hammer and be like, okay, where do I start? So,
1,000%. And where you're at, Reid, and why it's so fun talking to you is like I see myself kind of following in your footsteps of that's where we're at. Of, you know, did I have the land flipping business, which does well, it's fine. And, you know, I don't say that brashly or anything. Like it makes enough income for us to get by very comfortably. I've got the company that I'm starting with Dan, where we fund other people's deals, which has turned into what is this, you know, we're launching a fund to go, you know, raise money to go put into deals. And then long-term, I see it as that of the private equity firm where you go raise a bunch of money and then your definition of deal is, you know, ideally within the area of expertise that you and the team members have. So land development, you know, single family, multifamily, healthcare of like, I can't wait to go buy hospitals and go do hospital turnarounds, you know, in this private equity capacity, in this ownership capacity where I'm the corporate office that gets to say yes or no to things, as versus being beholden to whatever the corporate overlords say, for the almighty shareholders or whatever. So, I think there is that appeal, but there is also something kind of beautiful about whenever you're in that corporate environment. I'll speak for myself. I would complain of, man, healthcare specifically, it's so regulated. It's an extraordinarily regulated industry. You have so many different regulatory bodies, from CMS to Joint Commission to Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, and 50 other ones that oversee your operations. And then you've got corporate, you know, that oversees all of the internal operations. And then you've got, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley audits that, you know, are making sure your financial controls and the SEC and everyone else to make sure that everything is regulated. And then you come into this not unregulated, but this entrepreneurial world where you've got all these guys that are all these gurus teaching these courses about how to do stuff. And it's like moderately, like it feels slimy or illegal. And you're like, man, if I had that freedom to operate, I would be a freaking billionaire. And then you go into that world and you're like, actually, it's trickier whenever you have unlimited freedom. There is something nice to having that box and structure to be able to operate in and having all the SOPs to fall back on. So I don't know. It's funny. It's tricky. And I think it's relatable for those of us that came from corporate.
Well, but I also think it's a scratch. Each you want to scratch, meaning that, of course, as an entrepreneur, you want to go build it from scratch. And we're doing it, and I've done it, you've done it, and it's the calling. But as you become more efficient and you're seeing the level of energy that it requires to start something from scratch, well, you can still apply, again, all the same skill sets. And then instead of the widget that we do right now is we sell affordable housing, right? That's our widget. We rent out affordable housing. You do land or flipping. But what means that you don't have another widget of modular housing, of a plumbing company, or, you know, something that's needed that's not ever going to go out of fashion, but they've got old term mom and pop owners that are inefficient and they don't know how to market well. But you've got some, you've got some revenue coming in the door that keeps the lights on, but you can go now put petrol on it because you don't have to start that machine. The machine's already going. It just may not be as efficient as you want it to be. I'm actually really excited about that space. But tying it all back to your experience, it's about that coming from the corporate behemoth to, you've gone from one scale to the next, right? And then trying to find that happy medium. And I think there's, as entrepreneurs, we all evolve and ride that wave of entrepreneurship as things change and as our skill set changes. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, and this is a capitalism world, is that we want to make money for our investors, right? And it's just identifying opportunity. What are we good at our heart? We're good at identifying opportunities, raising money, and assessing risk. If you can do those three things, you can become an expert in different fields. Now, yes, we will stick to real estate or stick to, I'm not in the buying of hospitals, but I bet you there's a private equity firm out there that all about buying hospitals and weeding out those inefficiencies and hiring people like yourself to go out and do it. It's just the same thing on a different scale.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you made the point really great, and it's business is business. You asked a question earlier of how do you make a hospital more money? It's how do you make a land acquisition, sale, and development company more money? You bring in more deals that make you more money, and it costs less to do it. And I think whenever you can have those systems and understand the skill sets of yourself and the people within your team and on your team, you're able to just copy and paste that system into other business models to a certain extent. Now, with investors looking at you, you can't be the freaking shiny object syndrome that I have to, keep myself in my own lane of. I can't be like, hey guys, this is what our buy box is. It's, vacant land in these states and these markets with this criteria or whatever. And it's also ice cream trucks in the Midwest. Then you sound like the crazy entrepreneur where it's like, dude, you are all over the place. That is not integrated into your business or into your skill set or anything at all. You don't know anything about that. Why are you going after that? Because then you lose the track record that you've been developing and gaining, as versus what Reed and I are talking about, where it's house manufacturing businesses which is all related, and all the materials associated with building commercial and multifamily real estate, from steel to lumber to concrete and everything in between. Of, you can see how within the pipeline it touches what your current active business is. And then if you have that skill set of being able to get people to believe in you and having that track record and being able to go raise money and say, hey, this adds to our pipeline and it actually can help us in some capacity, and it's an operating business that we can improve the efficiency. And it's fine. Yeah,
it gets you excited, but it's also, you hit on something really key there, is it's a story, right? And when you can show experience, so yes, to the point of like, I'm not looking at existing businesses like an ice cream truck. I don't know anything about ice cream truck. I don't know anything about retail stores or restaurants. I'm not going to go open a restaurant. But I know steel manufacturing because I'm a qualified structural engineer, and I practiced engineering for nearly a decade. Like, I happened to just call someone the other day, and he was looking for money for his business. Now, I'm not looking to run the business, but hey, guess what? He's in a space that I know. He's in my backyard here in Los Angeles, but he needs some cash to help him get to that next level in his business career, and I can buy 50% of the company. Hey, we might have a relationship right now, and now I'm not going to go blast that to every investor, but I'm probably going to go to my select investors and say, guys, I've got this opportunity here. It's something interesting. Would you be interested? And it's not a ton of money. Like, it's still a lot of money, but it's not a ton of money in the grand scheme of things. And we've got an opportunity. And if it works, we can then go and apply, put a ton of petrol on it, because I know he wants to scale to a 200,000 square foot warehouse. And I'm getting a little bit off track, but I'm excited about you start small with someone like a person like that, because I'm actually backing him as a whore, as a jockey, because, I'm not trying to get the job. But it's like, you've got to be careful in who you select, like people invest in who you select with us, but then also how do you let it out to your investors to say, we're looking at other stuff. And it's not a blast, you know, here's a multifamily deal one day, and oh my God, here's a modular construction the other day. It's not too dissimilar, and I could see investors seeing the tie, the connection between the two. But it is, you know, and there's a lot of other groups out there, you know, to be named or not be named, and they do a very good job at, you know, they've just been multifamily. They've now pivoted into self-storage, they've pivoted into car washes, or they've pivoted into debt funds. And some people criticize them for it. I don't, because I see it as a way of that you're being an entrepreneur and you're finding opportunities. The purpose of your investors, to your investors, the role you play is identifying deals, assessing risk, and presenting those deals to them. They don't have to invest. It doesn't take any of their concentration away from anything what they're doing. It's just still in a realm of they're hunting for deals and presenting it to investors to see if they want to take it down. Thoughts and comments on that before we wrap up the show?
No, it gets me excited, and I agree. And what people need to realize is that gap right there, because the guy that is owning that steel manufacturing company clearly there's a gap between the institutional or even friend, you know, high net worth individuals or accredited investors and the operators. And if you can bridge that gap intelligently, where read it makes sense, because you, with your background as an engineer, you can assess the operations of a company, of a steel manufacturing company, way better than I could. I could look at a P&L and be like, highlight some things and be like, question mark right here, as versus going toward the factory and say, hey, these are glowing, you know, glaring red flags, or these are yellow flags, or these are green flags, where, yeah, you come in as a 50% partner that also has some decision-making authority to say, hey, we need to improve these operations in this capacity. So you're able to intelligently bring a deal to your investors of, hey, I assessed this, and, you know, with my background, this makes total sense. And then you're able to find that gap. And that's what's really excited about businesses. Say you do that and you make your more investors more money than you did on, you know, a potentially, you know, not failed, but unfortunate multifamily deal. And you're like, okay, well, I can maybe go get another one of these, or we can expand this business a little bit more, and the investors are happy. And I mean, that's how business is born, is you find a gap within the market and then you go and fill that hole.
Exactly. I mean, like it's the same idea that your land fund deal, right? Like you guys are finding an opportunity in the market that you never thought you'd be in, but because you've been in this other space, you're like, hey, there's an opportunity to go fund these pre-entitled land developments because there's no one out there doing it.
That's exactly it. And I mean, it's the same thing where, you know, you need to rein the horse in, you know, depending on how much money you have of, you know, I'll have frustrations with my bookkeeper, my accountant, or, you know, X person. I'm like, man, I should create an accounting firm for, you know, this specific niche within real estate investment and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, it's how business is born, is it's, you know, you find people that are better at you, that are experts in it. And depending on who you are, if you're the idea guy, you know, some of these ideas will stick, some won't. And as long as you're attempting to keep yourself within the lanes a little bit of, you know, not allowing your shiny object to get without the, you know, outside of the scope of whatever your core business is, which at the end of the day, it's real estate investing in either land that is shovel ready or development potential or already developed land, vertical, you know, commercial or multifamily or something like that. And you can see how far that could integrate at mm-hmm. any level. Mm-hmm. And then you can choose opportunities that your investors are comfortable with, depending on the risk that you're able to accurately assess by your expertise and your team's expertise. So yep. I don't know. Business is fun. It's just a game.
It's a lot of fun. And it's a way that it's taken me down a path of thinking about things critically, where my engineering brain is like, well, I can break it apart and put it back together again. But I want to know, you know, how the sausage is made. Like, I'm not one of those guys who just like, because I think the other thing you got to realize, and this is for the listeners, is like, we aren't flying by the seat of our pants and looking at these other businesses. Like, I am breaking that P&L apart, and I want to know what that expense is and how to be. Now, that's inherently clearly like you are, Mason, like I am. Like, I geek out on those numbers. But you got to love that stuff in order to assess risk, because you can't just be like, oh, this guy sent me a P&L and looks good. Like, no, like, go and spend 2 hours with him and break it apart and be like, what does all this mean? How many staff do you have? What are the operations like? What's your marketing team like? Oh, you don't have a marketing team. Okay, well, you're going to need to spend dollars on that. Like, so then you got to go out and build out a model, right? A pro forma, which a lot of these business owners don't know how to do. And then it's around managing investors and saying, okay, well, I can go sell this story. I've found you as the person who's, you know, who is the sort of the passionate person about it, like you were with your CEO job back in the hospitals. They found you and said, we can put him in charge, but he doesn't necessarily know about how to, we'll go raise the money, we'll go manage the investors, you keep doing what you're best at, and we'll perform a partnership. That is what I've found is my, you know, not necessarily superpower, but what I'm really growing is sort of flexing as a muscle as I get more into this private equity world, which is essentially what we're doing, raising money from investors for great opportunities, which happen to be backed by real estate. So,
well, I mean, I think that right there, and I think your background and your experience of like it, being an engineer, you have very detailed and very important plans that you're coming up and coming out with that go under a lot of scrutiny. And being able to take that kind of engineering analytical approach to a pro forma or, you know, just dissecting a profit and loss statement makes it so where you're going to have an eye for detail and be like, why is this line within your P&L so, like, why does it change every month? And sometimes the answer is obvious of, oh, our order comes in, you know, our order is placed every 8 weeks for this particular product, which is our most expensive product, and that's why. And I think just being able to have that experience to draw on, and not to say that you can't study in college or in grad school or watch, you know, YouTube videos, but whenever you have, you know, your boss or your boss's boss and 10 layers above you in corporate America and your job's on the line and you're going through your P&L, I mean, I remember those operating meetings or budget meetings with corporate where people would point out like one thing because they've looked at 50,000 pro formas or P&Ls in their career. And so they'll say, ask one question. And you look at your notes and you're like, shit, I didn't take notes on that. I don't know. I don't know. I need to know my operations better. But I think having, you know, that particular background of being able to get really granular when you're analyzing something is really important. But also on the flip end, you know, swinging the pendulum the other way, being able to be that entrepreneur that's able to go out and try and say yes to things, you know, to keep your options open and your mindset open to new opportunities as long as they're within the scope is what allows you to both be successful as well as grow and expand and not put a glass ceiling above your head.
I love it. I love it, mate. Well, look, at the end of every show, which I could talk to you for hours, and I'm sure we're going to have a few beers when we do meet up here in due course. Oh, yeah. But we'd love to dive in the top five investing tips. Ready to get into it?
Let's do it.
Mate, question number one is, what's a daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
Every day, check every lead that's in our system just to make sure that we're following up with them in some capacity.
Great. You're nearly like sales funnel guy.
I hate it, but I have to just make sure we're moving the ball forward. And yeah, eventually I'll offload that. But for now, that is something I do.
Yep. Question number two is, who's been the most influential person in your career to date?
Ooh, most influential person in my career to date. I think I'd be wrong if I said anyone besides my wife. We've been together since college, and she supported me through grad school, supported me through, you know, making my way in corporate America. And when people ask how you were able to quit your job and become a full-time investor, it's because my wife was a software engineer making six figures and we could live off her income. So without her, both moral, emotional, and financial support, we would not be in the position we're in right now.
That's awesome. Well, kudos to your wife. Question number three is, what's the most influential tool in your business? When I say tool, it could be a physical tool like a phone or a journal, or it could be a piece of software that you just can't run the business without. What is it?
I think that would be our CRM. It's Pebble. It's where we keep track of everything and anything. And it doesn't necessarily have to be Pebble, but you have to have some form of customer relationship manager if you are managing lots of leads.
You said Pebble?
Pebble. It's a land-focused CRM.
Gotcha.
So it's you can mail from there, you can call from there, has your deal tracking board and everything like that. So super easy, super functional for those of us that are more technology illiterate, easy to use CRM for land investors.
I've never heard of Pebble, but that question always brings up cool softwares that I need. Not that I'm in the land flipping, but like that you've never heard of, but it's cool. That's why I ask it. So Pebble, interesting. Mm-hmm. I'll write that down. Question number four is, in one sentence, what has been the biggest failure in your career? What did you learn from that failure?
Biggest failure of my career. Oof. That's a tough one. I think, you know, moving from corporate to the entrepreneurial world, I thought one of the biggest things that was going to happen is I was going to eliminate all stress. by, you know, being my own boss. And I think that while it's not exactly a failure yet, because it hasn't been realized, bad debt structuring and deals. There's deals that, you know, while my investor's investment is protected through various assets and everything like that, I've structured debt deals in ways that I would never structure them today, of, you know, personally guaranteeing $500,000 loans to get the deal done. And so I think in varying ways, like, protecting the investor's money is absolutely essential, but I think that I would not structure deals, you know, make sure that your debt is really well structured is all I'll say.
Yeah, no, but the problems we are all facing today in higher interest rate environments is because of the, if you've got floating rate debt or not, if you have got fixed rate debt, I'm sure you're sitting just fine. So, mate, quick last question, where can people reach you to continue the conversation? They'll be in your sphere. Where do they go?
LinkedIn is the best place to engage with me. So I imagine it'll be in the show notes, but on my website, masonrmcdonald.com, you can find my LinkedIn. I think my cell phone's on there, my email's on there. So reach out, you know, if you want to talk about land development, raising money, funding deals, or healthcare, whiskey, or watches, I'm here for it.
I love it, my friend. Well, look, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of the day. Just want to reflect some things that I took away from today's show. I think, you know, the story around being 26 years of age, coming into a CEO role at a hospital is just insane to me. I remember being 26, moving to the US and, you know, trying to make it in this world. So clearly that you have made your way up in a space that's very bureaucratic, but you were able to make it work. And I think we're both saying the same thing now as we have started businesses from scratch and now looking at other businesses with inefficiencies, and they're literally like mouthwatering because you're just like, oh, wow, it's so easy because I'm an outsider and I've done it before. So I think that's one of the biggest things I've taken away from today's show, your ability to identify inefficiencies in a structured environment, and then leaning into not shying away from building it from scratch, but then also understanding what you like and want to do moving forward to help you redefine the business. So did I leave anything out?
No, I think you nailed it. I mean, this was a ton of fun. I agree that we could talk for hours. Can't wait for that beer whenever I head out to SoCal this year. And yeah, this was fun, Reed.
Awesome, brother. Well, again, thank you so much for jumping on today's show. Enjoy the rest of your day and weekend, and we'll catch up very, very soon.
Thanks, Reed.
Well, there you have another cracking episode jam-packed with some incredible stuff from Mason. Remember, check him out on LinkedIn, Mason McDonald on LinkedIn. Anything you want to talk about, land flipping, land entitlements, or even land financing, he's got a fund that he's rolling out right now. And if you just want to pick his brain about inefficiencies in businesses, you know, like going from a CEO at a hospital to starting a real estate land flipping fund and business is completely separate, but they're all the same at the end of the day, definitely check out Mason, what he's doing out there. Again, I want to thank you all again for taking some time out of your day to continue to grow your financial IQ. It's what we do here on this show. All the show notes from today's show is up on our website at reedgoossens.com. Remember, share this show with your friends. If you think that people like this show, send it over to them. And then while you're there, give the show a 5-star review on iTunes. We'll do it all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.